We hope you enjoy this recording of a live broadcast brought to you via the ETIM Network, the online, live, interactive division of Torah in Motion. For more learning opportunities, please visit www.torahinmotion.org.
Let us begin. For those who are new, I want to thank, I don't see Rabbi Kelman on yet, he'll come on shortly, I assume. We've been running this now for a couple years. If you're new to Torah in Motion, I invite you to look at the website, all the interesting things they have. In addition, this is maybe the 42nd or 43rd talk in the series. I don't know how much longer we can go on great, not just great modern Orthodox thinkers, but great rabbis of the 20th century. We're going to be running out of them soon. We can maybe do it a few more times, but we'll have to move on to other topics. But it's really a continuing series. Some of you have been with me since the beginning, and therefore I'll be referring to things that I've mentioned previously. In fact, in a few minutes, I still have to mention a few things from the last time we met. It seems like so long ago. Those who do want to catch up or listen to some of the previous lectures, they're all available on the Torah in Motion website every now and then, and you can email Rabbi Kelman. They sell them all at one time for a very cheap. I think they're selling them for like $25 U.S. dollars for the whole lot of them. And in fact, we'll be starting with the Nazir today. Really, he was supposed to be in the last series, but we only gave him one lecture. This time we gave him two. We had so much to do last time that he got pushed off. For those who are new, let me just say quickly, you can, if you have questions, you can send them to me at the bottom there by typing them in. I'll stop every now and then and ask if there are questions. You can also, if you don't want to see anyone else, you can stack the pictures. There are just a few pictures I see here, but you can stack them. You can enlarge my picture. You can enlarge other people's. You can do lots of, you can play around with this while I speak. Most of you have been with us before, so I don't need, unless anyone has any questions, and if someone is not hearing properly, or if you lose, you can't see me or anything, there's a technical support on the left. You can click on him. And you can email, you can just not email him, but send him a message, and he'll try to get it working. Unless I start getting messages or see people waving their hands, I will assume that all of you can hear me fine and see me fine. So without any further ado, let us begin. This is, I don't know which is maybe the fourth of the series on modern Orthodox thinkers. And again, let me just briefly mention what I've said at the beginning of all these series. I don't mean at all to imply that these individuals are what, when we say modern Orthodox, what you get at your local shul, or what you maybe thought modern Orthodoxy was, what they are, all of them contribute in certain ways to what today is generally regarded as falling under the larger rubric of modern Orthodoxy. I mentioned Hirsch before, so I'll mention again that we spent a good deal of time on him, and yet Hirsch is known for a couple of things that are far from being what today would be regarded as modern Orthodox. His anti-Zionism, for one, and his religious separatism. And today, of course, if you think about modern Orthodox types, most of them are strongly Zionist and also believe in cooperating with the non-Orthodox. Or, for example, you think about Rabbi Soloveitchik, whom we haven't had sessions on, and yet he is, when you think about his Zionism, it's a very different type of Zionism than most people think about today. And there are other figures who are what I would call non-Zionist, but for many other reasons, do fall into the modern Orthodox type of ideology in certain important respects. So we'll bear this in mind. We'll keep coming back to it. But in trying to find sources for what today is identified as either centrism or modern Orthodox, all of these figures that we dealt with so far have had an impact. In this current series, both the Nazir has an impact in Israel, and Rav Chaim Hirschenson didn't have an impact in his lifetime, really, but is starting to have more of an impact. And Reinus and Kalischer are, of course, central. Religious Zionism is unimaginable without either of them. So we're dealing with two very, very important figures, and two who are not that important, but one in particular who is growing in importance, and then Nazir, one who's just so very interesting that he's worth looking at. Hello, Rabbi Kelman. And with that introduction,
Hi. Welcome. Hi. Thank you.
Thank you. with that introduction, I did mention that this is a continuing series, and I had conversations with a number of you over the long break, and the people who are listening, this is just those who are in the Eastern time zone or people in Australia, and David from Beit Shemesh, who can get up very early, but many more have listened to it on the MP3s, because they've been emailing me and asking me questions, so I could spend the next hour responding to all the questions and comments, but I'll just take a couple quickly, and then we'll move right into the Nazir. First, let me tell all of you, a number of you were fascinated by Rabbi Kafach, whom we spent two classes on, and we continue. Those who are interested, here is a DVD published. It's called Mori. Not published. They produced in Israel. Anyone who's interested, it's not like the documentary on the Rav, which is his whole life. It's really, it contains interviews with him and other Gedolim, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, Rav Avadi Yosef, and others, including professors, about Rav Kafach's significance, and it really focuses on his significance in the world of scholarship, what he achieved, and it's, as I said, it's quite fascinating. I think it's $20. They're selling it in New York now, but I mention it because a number of you were very interested in Rabbi Kafach, and I'll just Professor Bar Asher says in one of the interviews on it that with Rabbi Kafach, it's the end of Yemenite Jewry. He was the last rabbi trained in Yemen in the old Yemenite way. So it's very interesting. Just two other things before we move on. Thank you for the person who corrected me. I mistakenly referred to a camp, those who are from the New York area probably know it well, called Camp Masada. I obviously meant Camp Masad. I think I will even come back to Camp Masad in a few classes when we speak about religious Zionism, as we'll see. But for those who don't know, it was a Hebrew-speaking camp. There's even three of them. It evaporated, doesn't exist anymore, disappeared. That says a lot about American Orthodoxy, that Hebrew is not so important. And maybe we'll talk a little more about that. We ended last class, we were speaking about Ritzvi Yehuda Cook, and that really explains why we were dealing with the Nazir. Because although we broke it up, really they should go together, because Ritzvi Yehuda and the Nazir do go together. So one question about Ritzvi Yehuda, I think it was Rabbi Kelman even mentioned that he really believed in a form of Das Torah, and we'll get back to Das Torah, especially when we speak it with about Rabbi Reines. I did want to clarify, and I do thank one of you for emailing me, that the Das Torah that Ritzvi Yehuda spoke about was of the more of the Lithuanian type, that rabbis should be involved in politics. It wasn't the Hasidic type, where that the rabbis somehow have some sort of divine inspiration, which then also becomes somewhat of a Lithuanian type. That was not his approach. And finally, we spoke about Rav Cook, and we mentioned this was Arez, who's, I don't see him here. We spoke about his criticism of the Chevron Yeshiva students for wearing short jackets, and I'm informed by Shlomo Tukachinsky, scholar in Israel, writing his dissertation on the Chevron Yeshiva in the land of Israel, that this is a legend. There is no evidence that Rav Cook ever said that. Rav Alfandari, the famous Saba Kadisha, he criticized the Chevron Yeshiva Bachrim. But according to Shlomo Tukachinsky, and as I said, he's the expert on the Chevron Yeshiva, Rav Cook never criticized the Chevron Yeshiva Bachrim for the way they dressed, and we spoke about in previous classes how they dressed very modern and didn't look yeshivish. Okay, with that, we now move on to what we're supposed to do today, and that is the Nazir, Rav David Cohen, someone who I think many of you have heard of, but many of you have not heard of. In Israel, in religious Zionist circles, he is quite important, but in Chutz Haaretz, not so important. And why dedicate classes to him? Well, first, because I think he's quite interesting. His life is, in a sense, when I wrote my Rabbi Weinberg book, I think I was able to succeed to a certain extent because I wasn't just telling his life, I was telling also the story of an era. All the great events of Orthodoxy in the 20th century could be seen through his life. We see that to an extent with David Cohen. Not completely, but to an extent. No, Rabbi Kelman, I didn't disappear. Everyone else, I think, sees me. I think it's your computer. Okay, fine now. Also, there's been a great deal of writing in recent years about the Nazir. Just to show you one example, here's a book by Dov Schwartz, professor at Bar-Ilan University, called Religious Zionism Between Logic and Messianism. And who was on the cover there? You can see him. The Nazir. I mean, that's the symbol of who he wants to put on the book for this new type of Zionism, the Gush Emunim type of Zionism that we think about as being really revolving around Ratzi Yehuda Cook, but to a large extent, Rav David Cohen was right there. In addition, Dov Schwartz has another book, Challenge and Crisis in Rav Cook's Circle, and you see three people in this picture. You see Ratzi Yehuda, Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalap, and the Nazir at the bottom. So, in addition, and I couldn't have done these talks just a few years ago, we have seen the appearance in just the last 5 years of a number of books from the Nazir. We had stuff that he wrote, but here we have, for one, Mishnat HaNazir, which is his diary. We have Zachu Shchina Beinehem, which includes his discussions of marriage and love. We have, and I'm going to refer to all of these, Dodi Letzvi. It's a pun on Dodi David, David Cohen, and Letzvi Tzvi Yehuda. These are the letters from the 1920s, Ratzi Yehuda Cook and the Nazir. And I'll explain the significance of all of these writings in a little while. This, by the way, this diary that I mentioned isn't a diary of the sort that we think of. It's a spiritual diary. It's a diary of spiritual growth. There's different types of diaries. I just was reading over Shabbos Gershom Scholem's diary, which has some of that also, some of the spiritual stuff. But many diaries are more political or talking about what they were doing, who they met. I mean, I love diaries for that reason. You get the inside scoop. Mordechai Kaplan's diary is fascinating. But this is a different type of diary. This is a spiritual diary. We don't have many of them in traditional Judaism. In fact, Rav Lichtenstein, in his essay, one of his essays, I think it's the essay in the Schachter book on secular studies, and he says that we have nothing like Augustine's Confessions. I think it's that essay. I mentioned this in a previous class. And really, though, the closest thing we have to Augustine's Confessions, someone talking about their spiritual life and their growth, is, as far as I know, Rav David Cohen's spiritual diary. And it's not complete. There are things they didn't put in it, as I'll speak about. But this really isn't a genre reflecting. The whole notion of an autobiography is not a traditional genre. Yaakov Emden, as we mentioned once, he's really the first to do it, but it's not something that rabbis have traditionally done. Yes, Rabbi Kelman anticipated me. But because that's the exception that proves the rule. It's so unusual. And that is not a spiritual autobiography. That's an autobiography in which he discusses all the machlokas he had in his life. He talks about various sexual things that you couldn't imagine a Gadol Yisrael writing about. It's a very strange... whether it ever appears, J.J. Schachter thought he was supposedly going to publish it in English. Nothing seems to have happened, but maybe it'll appear in Hebrew. Yaakov Emden wanted people to read this because he thought this was part of Torah also, but reading about how he was almost seduced by his cousin and he was able to overcome it makes for strange reading, but he then uses it to prove a point that the Yetzer Hara has no power over him. Of course, you have all sorts of attacks against other rabbis, etc. In any event, it's not really a genre that traditional Jews have done. A book, Marcus Mosley published a book a couple years ago about this. The only other Orthodox figure I believe he deals with is the Rav Baruch Epstein, the author of the Torah Tamim and his Makar Baruch. And if any of you read the Sfarim blog, you know my opinion of the reliability of Rav Baruch Epstein's memoirs. Coincidentally, right about the time that these materials started appearing and I began to become interested in the Nazir, I had a lecture at my University of Scranton, and the speaker was David Dallin. Some of you might know the name because he just came out with a book about, he's a Musmach, by the way, of the seminary. He came out with a book just a few months ago about Hitler and the Mufti, which really was a major part of his last book, which some Jews liked and others didn't, about Pope Pius XII. He really was a whitewash, an argument that Pope Pius XII, maybe he's correct, was really a very good pope for the Jews. And that's what he was coming to speak in Scranton about. But as we're having dinner, we're talking, turns out he was a cousin of the Nazir, second cousin or something, because he's obviously much younger. So we spent the whole dinner, him telling me about his visits to Jerusalem, in the 60s and his meals with the Nazir. So it was quite fascinating. Incidentally, Rabshar Yashav Cohen, a figure we'll get back to, chief rabbi of Haifa, one of the leading religious Zionist post-scheme and authorities, is the son of the Nazir. He was in Rome just a couple weeks ago, and he spoke at a synod of bishops, the first Jew ever to do such a thing. And what did he do? He attacks the efforts to canonize Pope Pius XII, so it comes full circle here. So who is Rav David Cohen? Rav David Cohen was born in 1887 in a small town near Vilna. His father was the Rav of the town, and his grandfather was named Rav Zecharia Mendel Katz. I'm sure the name means nothing to anyone listening, but Rav Zecharia Mendel Katz was the Rav of the small hamlet, really a nothing of a town. And no one in Poland knows it, but it's named Rodin. And of course, we all know it. It reminded me when I was in Germany once, I'm riding on a train, and we're passing cities, not cities, tiny towns. I remember passing Rothenburg. And looking around saying no one on this train has any clue why that's significant to anyone, because today it has no significance. But all these towns, Speyer, Mainz, Rothenburg, when you pass, when you're on a German train, they mean something to us. The name Rodin, that's the Chafetz Chaim's town. In fact, other than the Chafetz Chaim, I don't know of anyone of any significance who was in Rodin. So had the Chafetz Chaim not been in Rodin, it would be like all these other towns full of Jews, all of whom were exterminated in the war, but that really don't have any significance for Jewish history. The Chafetz Chaim was not the Rav of the town. The Chafetz Chaim was a layperson. I don't even know, incidentally, if the Chafetz Chaim ever had, quote, smicha, hatarat hara'ah. That is, I don't know if he ever went to a rabbi and was examined on Yoredeya and given it. They say no. Of course, that would not be such a big deal, though the Rambam never had smicha either. It's an Ashkenazic thing, and you only needed it. Even today, you can be in yeshiva and kollel for 30 years. You never get the, quote, smicha unless you go out to Rabbanus. So I don't know if the Chafetz Chaim ever had it. Samuel Belkin studied in Rodin. Was he from Rodin? It's a good question. I will check that. He studied in the yeshiva. The Chafetz Chaim, a group gathered around him. There was like a kollel in Rodin. And then they had not only had the kollel, then they had a yeshiva there. Which is really, although they started it there because the Chafetz Chaim lived there and they wanted to be near him, but it was really separate from the Chafetz Chaim. It was an independent yeshiva. Rav Naftali Trupp was one of the Rosh Yeshiva. I don't know if Belkin was born in Rodin. It's a good question. I will check that and get back to you next week. Ah, you already checked it. He's born in Belarus. Okay, so we're still looking for someone other than Rav Yisrael Mera Cohen, that came from Rodin. But Zecharia Mendel Katz was from Rodin. Incidentally, this raises another issue which we can't deal with now. That is, how it is that the Mishnah Brura, which was not written by a Rav of a city, ever became so popular versus the Aruch HaShulchan. Now, if you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, it's much more lenient, and he has a pulpit. As a Rav of a community, he's dealing with individuals. He has a much different approach than the Chafetz Chaim, but the Chafetz Chaim was known as, when he died, he was known as the great, we really don't have saints, per se, in Judaism, but he was the greatest saint in Judaism. Chaim Soloveitchik speaks about this in his article. So Rav David Cohen, as a youngster, would go visit his grandfather. And that's where he came to know the Chafetz Chaim, and we'll see the significance that shortly. Yes, David points out the Chaye Adam. He worked in a store. He was a grocer. You had these great Talmidei Chachamim in Europe, or Menachem Zemba, martyred in the Holocaust. He was never practicing Rav. These people who became Rabbanim, it was usually when they had no choice. They weren't trained for anything else. Their dream would have been just to sit and learn or be supported by a father-in-law. In fact, Rav Yaakov Emden, we mentioned him before, so I'll mention him again. He joked that every morning he would make the bracha in the Shachri, Shalom Asani, Aleph Bet Dalet, not Aved, or, not Eved in the sense of slave, but Av Beis Din. He served as rabbi for a short period of time, and he was very thankful he got out of it, and he thanked God that he was able to have Parnassa without having to be work at the beck and call of others. At the age of 9, his father actually sent David Cohen to live with his grandfather permanently. Why did he send him there? No, the Chofetz Chaim was never based in Vilna. Chai Adam never had an official position, to my knowledge, ever, not even a short period. I will check on that. But I don't believe, he certainly was not based in Vilna. I shouldn't say certainly, maybe for a tiny period, but I don't believe so. I will check on that. Vilna, incidentally, did not have, during the Vilna Gaon's time, there was a terrible machlokes over the Rabbanus of Vilna. And after that, they decided they're never going to have a chief rabbi of Vilna. And this comes back to create a controversy in the 30s when the Mizrahi appoint this Rabbi Yitzhak Rubinstein as official rabbi. Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski was the unofficial rabbi, and Rav Soloveitchik in his Hesped for Rav Chaim Ozer alludes to this, and this is thought to be an act of great chutzpah by the Mizrahi when Rav Chaim Ozer was regarded as the unofficial Rav. Rubinstein is able to get out of Europe. He comes to America, and briefly he serves on the faculty of Yeshivas Rav Yitzhak Elchanan. Getting back to Rodin, he was sent to his grandfather, the Rav of Rodin, because there were no Malamdim, it's the old story, there were no Malamdim in his small town who could teach him. At the age of 9, most kids in those days, by 12, 13, they were out working. So if you're a smart 9-year-old, you're the equivalent of a 13, 14-year-old, there's no one to teach you in town. So he sent him to Rodin. He wasn't in Rodin very long. He left there. He went to Volozhin, where he studied for a bit. This was not the Volozhin of the Netziv. This was the Volozhin after it had closed down. It reopened again under the leadership of Rafal Shapiro. Rafal Shapiro is the son-in-law of the Netziv and also the father-in-law of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. But it was never a great yeshiva after it reopened. And I know there's a Volozhin in Israel, but they just took the name. If you look at Charles Stamper's book, hopefully soon it'll appear in English, he discusses the Volozhin Yeshiva. He doesn't even pick up after it reopens. He stops when it closes. So this wasn't the great Volozhin Yeshiva. It never had the prestige of the original Yeshiva. In 1903, he's 16 years old, he returns to Rodin, and that's where he develops this very close relationship with the Chofetz Chaim. After all, the Chofetz Chaim was closest of friends to his grandfather. They would always spend time together, and he would always spend time with the Chofetz Chaim. In 1905, he goes to Slobodka. The people who are at Slobodka at this time are all the Gedol Yisrael. I mean, it's incredible when you look at the list of people. But he was only there a short while, and then he had to move on, a few months. It was during this time, in Slobodka, that he, like so many others, began to be attracted to things other than Talmud. For him, it was primarily Jewish philosophy, the Rambam, Rav Sadia Gaon. I don't think in the entire Slobodka Yeshiva there was a Mor Nevuchim, that there was a Sefer Amunos Tadeos. These were not part of the curriculum. Part of Rav Kook's great innovation is that you need to put these works back in the curriculum. And although there are sections of that that are really irrelevant to modern times, I mean, medical explanations for kashrus, which we don't accept today, and all sorts of things, scientific understandings. However, the underlying spiritual message of these books are eternally significant. But these were not part of the curriculum, and it's not just them. Tanakh wasn't part of the curriculum either. Lots of things weren't part of the curriculum of the traditional yeshivas. But that really wasn't the problem. The problem was he started getting interested in secular learning also. Just like Rabbi Yehuda Jacob Weinberg, just like so many others, he wanted to broaden himself. There were those people in the yeshiva, Slobodka in particular, but also Tells and others, who saw that they were entering a new era, and that it wasn't just enough to be a Talmudist. And even without this overarching reason, they needed more. They could not be contained simply by Shas and Poskim. I mean, the Rav Soloveitchik is a perfect example of that we have these people. He also develops an interest during this time in Slobodka in what in those days was known as Chachmas Yisrael, Wissenschaft, academic Jewish studies, which, as we've spoken about so often, were standard for the Orthodox in Germany. These were absolutely pasul, forbidden, for the Orthodox in Eastern Europe. This was not to the liking of the Alter of Slobodka, of the Slobodka Yeshiva leadership, especially since a group of students had begun to gather around David Cohen, and he would give shiurim to them. In fact, even after he was advised to leave the yeshiva, and he had an apartment in the city, these people would come to his apartment, and he would speak to them, give shiurim to them. Where to go then? He's asked nicely, or maybe not so nicely. You know, when you read this, the books that talk about this, you know, they always describe it that it wasn't, they made it clear to him that this wasn't the place for him. But for all we know, he was kicked out. It's like with Shaul Lieberman. If you read Kamenetsky's book, he talks about how Shaul Lieberman was kicked out of Slobodka. I don't know if he was or not, but it's hard to know. What we can say is they came to a mutual agreement that Slobodka was not the place. So he goes to St. Petersburg. What's in St. Petersburg? Why go to St. Petersburg? Well, there was a man in St. Petersburg named David Gunzberg. If you're interested in this Gunzberg family, which is a family of bankers, industrialists, philanthropists in Russia and in Paris, there's a long article in the Encyclopedia Judaica that speaks about this family, the Gunzberg family. And they were the unofficial leaders of the Russian Jewish community. The Rav Yitzchok Chanan Spector was in close contact with them. And there was one individual named David Gunzberg. He actually was a baron, Baron David Gunzberg. And as I said, he was very involved in philanthropy and communal work, but he's also best known for his work in academic Jewish studies. He was an expert in Hebrew. He was an expert in Jewish history. He was an expert in Arabic. He published a number of volumes in these areas. He was also involved in bringing Haskalah, moderate Haskalah, secular learning, to the Jewish community. And he was a wealthy man. He opened an academy, an academy they called it for Oriental studies, which means for academic, for Near Eastern studies, study of Arabic, Jewish studies, in Moscow. He funded it himself, he supported the students, and he paid for the teachers. And he himself was one of the teachers. He taught Talmud, rabbinic literature, Arabic literature, Semitic languages, and medieval Jewish philosophy. In addition to all this, he ran businesses and was a very wealthy man. In addition to him, we have other great people taught there. Shimon Dubno, the great historian, martyred in the Holocaust, he taught there. Among the students, who were some of the students who studied at this was an institute to study Near Eastern studies, Jewish studies, Zalman Shazar, great president of the State of Israel, he was studying there. Solomon Zeitlin, who comes to America, to Philadelphia, becomes a great scholar of Second Temple times. He's very idiosyncratic because to the end of his life, from the 1950s until the end of his life in the 70s, he insisted that the Dead Sea Scrolls were a medieval work. This was even after they did the carbon dating and everything else. Those who went to YU might have been influenced by Zeitlin because he had a student. His leading student was a guy named Sidney Honig. He was a rabbi in Flatbush, but he also was a great scholar of Second Temple period and taught at Yeshiva for many, many years. Solomon Zeitlin himself taught at Yeshiva in the 1930s. If you read Rakefet's book on Bernard Revo, he describes the conflicts between Zeitlin and the Russian Yeshiva, who didn't like the scholarship that Zeitlin was publishing. Yecheskel Kaufman, the great Yecheskel Kaufman. How many volumes of his studies of biblical Judaism did he write? Moshe Greenberg summarized them into one very large volume. He was a student there as well. And David Cohen. Now, all these students were geniuses. And none of them had any, they were all Luftmenschen. They had no interest in the practical world, how to make a living, how to make parnassa, what to do. They were like, this was a kollel of people who were studying in a non-traditional environment. Sometimes I think it's similar to what they have in Israel now, these Beit Midrash, the Beit Midrash that have opened up for the secular Jews who just want to learn for the sake of learning. We take this for granted. But really, how many of us learn for the sake of learning? Go into the local yeshiva, go into the local kollel, and ask people why they're learning. And 9 times out of 10, they'll tell you because it's a mitzvah. Hashem wants us to learn, something like that. Is that really lishma? Are they learning for the sake of learning? Take away that, like the Vilna Gaon once said, he wanted to sell all of his schar for all his learning, or all his mitzvahs, and do it for its own sake. How many would still be learning if it was just learning for the sake of learning, pure intellectual pursuits? I don't know how many. Certainly the great scholars would, but I don't know about the others. In other words, learning becomes a form of ritual for most of us. I'm not saying that's bad. That's part of traditional Judaism. But there's a higher form of learning where it's just for the sake of knowing itself. And these were the people who were there. Incidentally, Ginsberg's brother-in-law was the father-in-law of Isaiah Berlin, the great philosopher Isaiah Berlin, who himself was from a Chabad family. His tefillin actually went back either to the Tzemach Tzedek or to the Alter Rebbe, the tefillin that Isaiah Berlin used. And I keep saying I'm going to have to contact someone in his family. What became of these tefillin? The Institute, it was called something like the Institute of Oriental Studies. If you look in the Encyclopedia Judaica article on Ginsberg, it has it. There might even be a separate entry on it because so many of the great scholars passed through that institute. But the time came that David Cohen had to leave St. Petersburg, and he did what everyone did in those circumstances. He went to Germany to attend a university. That's what everyone did. And he did not go to Berlin. He went to Freiburg, a small town, but a university, University of Freiburg. This is in 1913. But before doing so, he goes to the Chafetz Chaim. He wants to speak to the Chafetz Chaim. He wants to get a bracha. You know, you're going into Germany. Who said it? I forget which Gadol said it. Weinberg said it also, but he wasn't the first, that Germany was a very cold place. It's good for the German Orthodox, but for people who are used to East European Judaism to come to Germany, there was a lot of fears how they could be influenced. So he went to the Chafetz Chaim. And as the Nazir tells the story, and this is recorded in a couple places, his son also tells the story. He goes to see the Chafetz Chaim, and the Chafetz Chaim starts asking him in detail about every member of his family. Now, all of his uncles were rabbis, all of his aunts were married to rabbis, so he's going through about every one of these, what his uncle's doing, that uncle's doing, and he was going to get some sort of bracha, to speak to the Chafetz Chaim. You know, here he's really leaving the homeland and going to this foreign land, and so far, nothing. The Chafetz Chaim hasn't even spoken about any of these issues. Then suddenly, the Chafetz Chaim stops and says to him, "In previous years, when we davened, Hashem es avodu levir betecha, that God should bring back the sacrificial service, rebuild the temple, this was just a prayer, but now it's becoming a reality." The Chafetz Chaim says to David Cohen, "I don't know if I will live to see it, but you, Reb David, you will at least live to see the beginnings. The time is coming," he told David Cohen, "that the temple is going to be rebuilt, and there will be difficult halachic questions. Who will people turn to for these problems? They're going to turn to the rabbis. And among the rabbis, first they're going to turn to us. They're going to turn to the Kohanim. If we don't study the laws of Kudshim, the laws of sacrificial service, then no one's going to know the answer to these questions. We must study Kudshim to prepare for the redemption." And this was a theme of the Chafetz Chaim. In years after this, he stressed this. A Kudshim Kolel opened up. People would study that in Rodin. You had one in Brisk also. His son-in-law, Rav Aaron Cohen, writes a book. It's a classic. It's been reprinted probably four or five times, Avodas HaKarbonos. This becomes a major theme for the Chafetz Chaim, that in our era we must know this information. And he tells us to David Cohen that he must become an expert in Kudshim. He tells Rav David that he must promise him that he will learn a daf of Gemara a day of Kudshim. And David Cohen purchases the one-volume Shas. I don't know if any of you have seen the one-volume Shas. It's just Gemara and Rashi. It's about this thick. And he begins to study one daf a day. Let me go in by the way, before we go further, and fill in a biographical point. In St. Petersburg, he would often spend Shabbos with his uncle. St. Petersburg, you could stand, but it wasn't such a big Jewish community. In fact, all the Jews in St. Petersburg were there. They had special permission to be there. Until the Tsar falls in 1917, there was something called the Pale of Settlement. Jews were forbidden to live outside of certain areas. If you were rich and had connections, you could get approval to live in St. Petersburg and Moscow. My grandfather, incidentally, he was a chazan. And they were in the city of Novozibkov. That's where Zevin, where Shlomo Yosef Zevin was the Rav of that city. But they would go, they had special permission. They would go to St. Petersburg to lead the services at one of the synagogues there. But they had to get a special, you know, papers, whatever they called it, to go. And then they had to leave when the holiday was over. So there isn't much Jewish life in St. Petersburg. He would go for Shabbos, back to the Pale of Settlement, to an uncle who was a Rav of a city. A town, and while there, he connected emotionally to a cousin. He had a cousin, a girl cousin named Sarah, and he would come for Shabbos, and they talked to her and meet her, and they clearly were made for each other. His parents agreed to the match, her parents agreed to the match. For reasons we don't know, they could not get married immediately in 1913, or 1912, why couldn't they get married? We don't know why. It could be because he didn't have Parnassa. I mean, there used to be a concept even among in the yeshiva world. They would get married late. Yeshiva Bachrim in the Slobodka Yeshiva did not get married at 20 and 21. Some of them won't get married until they're 28, 29, 30. Unless you had a rich father-in-law and you had to get yourself settled Parnassa-wise. I'm assuming that's the reason. He leaves her to go to Germany, no doubt assuming she would soon follow. But they were engaged. He leaves her in 1913 in Germany. They are engaged. And the relationship becomes an incredible love story. The love letters that Rav David Cohen wrote to his fiancée survive. And the diary entries in which he discusses his feelings for her also survive. However, they were not published in the diary, and they haven't published these love letters in the introduction. Rav Shar Yashiv, who tells us about these letters, he doesn't cover it up. But the attitude is that these are private. I think it's more than that. I think also the idea that you don't want to publish love letters of a Gadol B'Yisrael. But the very fact that he did have these letters is significant. Now, during his time away from her, World War I breaks out. She cannot leave Russia during World War I. He cannot return to her. They're separated for years now. And then the Russian Revolution. And she's stuck behind the Iron Curtain. The months turned into years. Sarah becomes active in the underground Zionist movement in Russia, now the Soviet Union. They were not engaged in a halachic sense. When we say engaged, that's kiddushin. No, they weren't engaged in a halachic sense. She is involved in the underground Zionist activities. She actually studies agriculture at the University of Leningrad, so that when she comes on Aliyah, she can help in rebuilding the land. The couple was separated for 12 years, if you can imagine that. It was only then that, I guess I'll make it around 1924, it was only then that Rav Kook was able to arrange a certificate for her. Until World War II, it was still possible to leave the Soviet Union if you had a certificate to go to America or Israel. We spoke about this in the classes on Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Kook was able to arrange a certificate for her, and she was able to leave. Of course, she had to leave her family. And that's when they were able to reunite. But listen, by the way, after she leaves, very shortly after she leaves, the secret police come to her house to arrest her, to send her to Siberia for counter-revolutionary activities, for Zionist activities. But fortunately, she had already left the Soviet Union. Now, we have eyewitness testimony about their reunion. Rav David was in the Beis Medrash in a tiny Zdibor. He would often do a tiny stibor. That's a fast where you don't speak. And we're going to speak in a few minutes about who does tiny stibor, what type of spiritual personality we're talking about. But he would do these fasts, instead of fasting with food, where you don't talk. It's a way of, truthfully, when you think about it, they do it in monasteries also. Some of them, they don't speak. It's a way of focusing your mind on spiritual matters. He would sit, and on this day that she arrives in Jerusalem, and he knows nothing about that she's there yet, he knew she was coming. He didn't know she was, when you get a message, a telegram, that she's leaving the Soviet Union, or she just left the Soviet Union, it could be weeks, months, but he knows she's coming. He's in the Tanis Dibur. He's wearing talis and tefillin, which he would always wear. He'd walk around all day with talis and tefillin. She arrives. Before even seeing him, She goes to Rav Kook, and Rav Kook summons the Beis Din for a special meeting. He brings in Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and Rav Yeruchim Fishel Bernstein. They were members of the Beis Din. They summon the Nazir. The Nazir comes in, and there is his bride, who had come that morning. The Nazir is still in his tiny stibor, and Rav Kook has summoned the Beis Din to be Matir, the tiny stibor, to permit him to speak. They haven't spoken in 12 years. I don't even know how many letters they were able to send. This was actually not an actual neder, not an actual vow, but this was a semi-vow that he would take. And it's always best to be matir, to avoid these things halachically. I mean, we do this before Rosh Hashanah sometimes. People have the custom of doing this. I mean, if you look at halachic authorities, they have all sorts of questions. Like, let's say you grew up in a family that kept gebrots. And then you learn a little more and you realize that's really not a halachic issue. And can you just stop eating gebrots? Most poskim will tell you that even though you didn't take a vow, since you were accustomed to do this, it's as if it's like a vow, and it's best to do a hataras nadarim. Rav Avadi Yosef has an interesting tshuva on this in Yechav Adas. He says that if you knew that there's no halachic basis to the gebrots, then you don't need a, and you just were doing it, then you don't need a, you can just abandon it. However, if you actually thought that this was the halacha, that you couldn't eat kenedlach on Pesach, then you were, although you were under mistaken impression, you were doing it for quasi-halachic reasons, or for halachic reasons, actually. Therefore, you have to do bimatir the neder. But that's what I mean. So they are matir the neder. And this is the first time he could speak to his bride that he hasn't seen in 12 years. They sat together for the longest time with tears in their eyes. And again, we have eyewitness testimony about this. And Rav Shar Yashav Cohen records that his mother is terrified that, you know, they haven't seen each other in 12 years. Do they still have anything in common? When she left him, he was a yeshiva bachar. Now she comes in, a guy in talus and tefillin, with hair down to his shoulders. For heaven's sake, he's a Nazirite. She's coming to get her new husband here, is a person who doesn't speak, he wears tefillin all day, and he has a Nazirite. She wonders, she says to Rav Kook, do we have anything in common? Is this the man whom I left? Can I still marry this person? And Rav Kook declares that despite the appearance, he still is the same person. He still is bound to her in love. In fact, we know the Nazir kept a picture of her on his desk for all those years, always so that he was able to look at it, because she was his soulmate. And Rav Kook performed the wedding that day. They were married 50 years. And as I said, this is an incredible love story. Dov, just before we go further, Dov's question.
Rav Moshe agrees with what Dov is saying. That's in his tshuva. Seger's Moshe has tshuva like that.
Rav Avadia says, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm 99.9% sure I'm not wrong. He says that if you thought it was halacha, and that's why you kept it, you need hatara, but if you knew that it wasn't halacha, and you just were doing it because your father's minhag is to do that, but you knew that it's not really a minhag, then you don't need hatara sandarin, because you knew that it was it's nothing. You knew that it wasn't a real minhag. That's what Rav Avadia says. It's in Yechav Adas, but I will check on that. I didn't recall the Igros Moshe, but I'll check on that, and I will report to you next week, Dov, if I am mistaken on this. But thank you for asking this. Now, back to the touching love story. What I will say is that this is a beautiful love story, and I could speak a little more about it, but I want to move on to other things. It would never appear in an art scroll-type publication. Now, truth be told, and maybe defending art school, I don't know if we have any other gedolim in our history who've had this type of love story. For most of them, it was simply they were given a shidduch and they married the woman, and I'm not going to say they didn't love her afterwards, but it wasn't before. In fact, how many Divrei Torah are there in Sfarim that talk about, if you look, we'll read it in a few weeks, where Yaakov, first they marry, and not Yaakov, Yitzchak. He sees her and then he loves her. The love is supposed to come afterwards, not before. We have so many different Divrei Torah that focus on this, but here we have just the exact opposite. Rav Aaron Cutler, there we have an example of a love story, perhaps, and that created all the controversy of the Nussan Kamenetsky book, because he talks about letters, which apparently were love letters that he was writing. So you're right, thank you. And, of course, Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik's the perfect example. He couldn't find his way in the traditional world of Eastern Europe, and that's the tragedy of Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, is that he couldn't be in such a marriage. He needed, just like the Rav, they needed women who they could relate to emotionally and spiritually, not with the Shidduch system. So you're right, we do have examples of this. But it would never be recorded in the hagiography, and it's a shame because it says something about the people. Yeah. Alan, that's true. We'll talk about this as we go on. As I said, it was. Let's go back though before we get back to Israel. I mean, I mentioned him that he's a Nazirite. We haven't even discussed how he becomes a Nazirite. Well. He goes to Freiburg in 1913. The war breaks out in 1914, and he's arrested as an enemy alien. We've already spoken about this. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg is arrested. Rav Kook is arrested. All these people who have the Russian citizenship are arrested. He's put together in some sort of concentration camp, not like a concentration camp, detention facility. And he meets this rabbi. His name is Yirmiyahu Noy. We don't really know anything more about this rabbi. But we know that he was a mekubal, a Kabbalist, which is very unusual for Russian rabbis. And this is where David Cohen receives his first exposure to Kabbalah. Very important. He was fortunate. He was able to get papers to Switzerland. Rav Kook also gets papers to Switzerland. That's why the Hashgacha Pratit, or the coincidence, depending on your outlook on this, is so amazing. The Nazir goes to Switzerland. He gets off the first decent-sized town on the, you go, that the train stops at is Basel. Not a very big city, but it's a city with a nice Jewish community of, by then it was probably 50-year-old Jewish community, now it's more, obviously 150, maybe 130, and it's always had learned rabbis since then. At this time, the Rav was Rabbi Arthur Asher Cohen, who I think maybe was the first of the official rabbis. He becomes one of the founders of Agudas Yisrael. He's the grandfather, incidentally, of Gabi Cohen, Dr. Gavriel Chaim Cohen, a biblical scholar in Israel, also the principal for many years of Machon Gold. I'm sure some of you or some of your wives attended Machon Gold. Basel is fascinating. It's one of those places where for the last 120 years, since the first Rav, earlier Rav Asher Cohen, there hasn't been any uprooting of the community. There was no Holocaust. There's no assimilation. It's the same community, the same minhagim, the same things that they did 120 years ago, they do now. In fact, in Basel, and you can contact, incidentally, the rabbi of Basel today. His name is Folger. He's a YU Musmach, but I believe he comes from Belgium. In Basel today, they still repeat words in Shmona Esrei. The Chaz, in other words, in the Chazar Sashat, still repeats the words, because in places like Basel, minhagim never change. All the Chazanim in America 20 years ago, 30 years ago, they would repeat words. Of course, everything changes. Minhagim don't change in places like Basel. So if they repeated words 30 years ago and 100 years ago, that's the same way they do it. So it's a very interesting community. He comes off. He's, of course, a nobody. They don't know who he is. He goes to the shul, and they soon see that he's a very talented person. They offer him a position to give a shiur in the Beis Medrash every day. Instead of the Rav had been giving the shiur, but he was very busy with other things. He was looking for someone to take over for him. It's like most Rabbanim, if they can get someone to do the Daf Yomi, they're very happy. Rabbanim are very busy, yeah. He remains in Basel 7 years. And in addition to the daily Talmud shiur, he studies philosophy and Roman law at the University of Basel. He was also head of the Jewish Student Society and lectured to them on philosophy. We have an article he wrote from this time, and it was during his time in Basel that he has the most important meeting of his life, the meeting that would change him forever. Rav Kook is now in Switzerland, 200 miles away, and Rav David must meet him. Rav David doesn't know anything about Rav Kook personally, but he knows him from reputation. I don't even know if he had seen Orot. Orot, he certainly hadn't seen Orot. Orot hasn't appeared. He had seen certain articles he had written, and you can read the letters he wrote in this book to Rav Kook and Ritzi Yehuda about this meeting. And he knew even before he got to Rav Kook that this is someone special. This is someone unique. This is someone who comes along once in a generation. In preparation for the meeting, Rav Kook was in St. Gallen. He does Tevila in the Rhine River. And in his diary, he writes about this meeting. quote, a new era in my life began. I became a new man, a new heart and spirit. He writes about how he no longer feels any connection to his family. There was Bitu Hayesh, complete abolishing, effacing of his personality, of anything in personal life. He had become a completely new man. Complete love, complete holiness, complete Kedusha fills him. I mean, you might be saying, well, this is a bad thing, you know, Bitu Hayesh. This is always the problem with these mystics. Not just in the Jewish tradition, even non-Jewish. The big criticism of the Buddha. What happens with the Buddha? You want to reach nirvana, so you want to get rid of all these attachments. So Bitu Hayesh, and what about personal attachments? What about love for your children? There's this conflict here. But he writes that personal attachment to his family was finished. He doesn't have children yet. This is just his parents or his siblings. He writes as following in his diary. Pages 31 and 32. I'll read you from the English. I'll translate into English. Let me just read by quickly in Hebrew, for those who know Hebrew, how he describes this. He talks about Batal Gamrei Ha'ani, that is his ego, was completely effaced. Bitu Hayesh, Uv'Avat HaKol, V'Sharei Kedusha, V'Sharei Bino Yona, Niftachu Afanai. Then he says, in the diary, and this is a point added, this is from later years, reflecting, 27 years ago, I was in Basel, studying philosophy in all the different eras, full of desires for truth, in particular, Jewish truth. Word came to me that the Rav, who's the Rav? We know the Rav is Rav Kook, the Rav is there. He's in Switzerland. I wrote to him in a letter, and when I received his answer, I decided I must go meet him. After doing tevila in the Rhine River, together with, hold, it means mitsuyad. What is mitsuyad? Holding on, holding, or attached with the Shari Kedusha, Rav Chaim Vital, full of doubt, you know, what's going to be. I made my way to the Rav, Erev Rosh Chodesh Elul, 1915. I came to him. I found him involved in halacha with his son. They were focusing on Greek philosophy and how it doesn't really get to the truth. I stayed with them overnight, sleeping in my bed. I didn't sleep. My heart didn't sleep. My whole life is hanging in the balance. Akapot maznayim. And here, early in the morning, I hear a voice. Birkat HaShachar, Tefilas HaKeda, in song, holy song, singing. I'm listening, and I become a new man, Ishacher. After the davening, I ran a miharti. I quickly wrote in a letter, I guess a letter to his family, more than I thought, more than I expected, Yoter Masher Pilalti, more than I could hope for, Matsati, I found. Matsati Li Rav. I have found a Rav. Rav David Cohen never had a teacher that he could call his own. In the early morning hours, 4 or 5 in the morning, whatever it was, he hears Birkas HaShachar, not Shemona Esrei, not Shema. He hears the holiness, he hears the Kavanah, he hears the singing of Rav Kook's davening. It's been said by many that if we could have Kavanah on Yom Kippur, the way Rav Kook had Kavanah for Birkas HaShachar, we'd have achieved something. And when he hears this, he knows. It's as if he sees the holiness opening before his eyes. He has found a Rav. And from that point on, he becomes the closest of disciples. His soul is bound to Rav Kook, and Rav Kook's soul is bound to him. There are three great disciples of Rav Kook. They're on the picture here. Each one of them is bound to Rav Kook in their own way. Each one of them gets something specific from Rav Kook. You have Zakov Moshe Charlap. You have Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook, whom we've spoken about, and you have the Nazir of David Cohen. Incidentally, Rav David Cohen becomes bound in spiritual love for 50 years with Rav Tzvi Yehuda also, and that's the focus of this book, Hodoti Letzvi. Ah, good question about his opposition to the Nazir's academic Jewish studies. No. And we'll get back to that next class a little bit, but Ari Schweit, who teaches at the Orot College in Israel, has written a number of articles on Rav Kook and academic Jewish studies. And what he's shown is that, with the exception of Rav Tzvi Yehuda and Yaakov Moshe Charlap, really the whole second level of students, and the Nazir is the first level, were all involved in academic Jewish studies. You have Binyamin Menashe Levin, you have Hillel Seidel, you have his own brother. They were all. So Rav Kook had a great love for academic Jewish studies, and he even wrote about how we have to make it holy. Rav Kook writes in a book that was published just 2 years ago, his new diaries, Kvatzim, his new notebooks, that academic Jewish studies are gufei Torah. They're the essence of Torah as well. So it's he had a very positive view of academic Jewish studies. Rav Gorin also involved himself early on, but Rav Gorin was not, I wouldn't even call Rav Gorin, Rav Gorin was very young. Rav Gorin was born in 1917. He was only 18 when Rav Kook died. I wouldn't even call him on the second level. I wouldn't even call him the third level. He wasn't officially a Talmud. He was a Talmud of Rizzo Zalman Meltzer. He got a Haskama from Rav Kook, but he never was a student of Rav Kook. He never went to America. He was a Chevron student and a student of Eitz Chaim. Yes, I will discuss the Nazir and his academic things, and also what Rav Kook did think of them as his Talmidei Mufakim to a certain extent. He encouraged them in this academic Jewish life. Rav Kook believed that there's different approaches for different people. For those who were attuned to the academic world, he encouraged them in this and wanted to bring this into traditional Jewish studies. For those who were not attuned to it, he didn't. So Rav Kook was very broad. And as I said, I have PDFs of these articles that one just appeared about 2 months ago. I can send you PDFs of all these articles from Ari Schweitz in which he documents Rav Kook's views of academic Jewish studies. So we go to 10 o'clock and then I take questions. Just whoever wants them, please email me and I'll send them all to you. Now, many people believe, and Rav Kook, they were separated a bit when Rav Kook returns in 1919 to the land of Israel, but the Nazir comes shortly after that. No, and when I say email me to my email account, shapirom2@scranton.edu, and I will send what you need. Because after we're done this, I don't see this. Many people think, and it even appears in print, that this is when the Nazir became a Nazir, with this incredibly spiritual moment with Rav Kook. And if you don't know about the history, it makes a lot of sense. After all, here he's in the University of Basel, he meets Rav Kook, he becomes his lifelong Talmud, but it's not true. He actually became a Nazir during the period that he was held prisoner by the Germans in 1914. I heard this from Naomi Cohen, his daughter-in-law. Naomi Cohen, married to Rashar Yoshev. She is, incidentally, she's a Philo scholar in her own right. She is the daughter of Herbert Goldstein, if the name means anything to you, former rabbi of the West Side Institutional Synagogue. At one time, there were three great rabbis in New York City, Rabbis Jung, Lookstein, and Goldstein. Jung at the Jewish Center, Lookstein over at KJ, QF Cheshirin, and Goldstein at the West Side Institutional Synagogue. His father-in-law was Harry Fischel, who gives so much money to Rav Kook, and his son-in-law, then Goldstein's son-in-law, is Aaron Reichel. Some of you might know him from New York. Now, in the Encyclopedia Judaica, it mistakenly says that he took the vow in Switzerland while he was a student, but it wasn't. That wasn't the case either. It was under the influence of this rabbi, this Mekubo. He became a Nazir, and Naomi Cohen told me that it wasn't a formal vow of Nazirus. It was one of these more, I accept upon myself to be a Nazir, but not in a halachic sense, but he never broke it. Now, and we'll end with this this class. You can just imagine what people must have thought of him. I mean, here he is. You're in the university in Basel. You're in, you show up in this university, and he gets off the train. He arrives in Basel. He's looking like a hippie, like some guy from San Francisco, Haight-Ashbury or something. And then he lives there 7 years or so. He's going to the university with hair down. Obviously, we're dealing with someone. I have pictures of him here. I don't know how well you could see it. You see a picture of him with Mordechai Cohen, the son of the rabbi of Basel. I don't know if you could see him. There's David Cohen in Basel. Here's another picture. I mean, just put yourself for a minute what you would think if some guy shows up. We all have these crazy guys who show up in our towns, and a guy with long hair, and you say, well, what's with the long hair? And he says, I'm a Nazir. I mean, until you get to know him, and remember, he was giving Shir and Gomorrah there and other things for all those years in Basel as a Nazir. So we're dealing with someone who clearly is unusual, and we'll see in a few minutes more, but a very special person. And next class, we talk about the Aliyah to Israel and really ideologically what he gives, because he becomes Ezra Tzvi Yehuda and Rav Kook, of course, the next most important in the Merkaz Harav world of religious Zionism, next most important thinker. What is his angle? What does he offer? And the holiness that we'll speak about is really, that's what makes him unique. Sort of like a Rav Aryeh Levine type, although even without speaking about his ideology and his philosophy, just the figure, the idea that a person could live as a Nazir in the 20th century, and I'll speak at the beginning of the next class, what leads someone to become a Nazir? Where do you get this? Other than since Second Temple times, I'm only aware of one other Nazir in all of Jewish history. But we'll talk about that next class. If we have comments or questions, we could take them now. Well, I'll talk about that next class. Obviously, Jews were not ascetics, but there are exceptions. So that's, I'll begin next class speaking about where does someone, a yeshiva bachur, a holy person, come off becoming a Nazir? What about, we're supposed to have Kiddush, we're supposed to drink wine, we have Passover Seder. I mean, we'll speak about that next class. Yes, he does not drink wine, and I will explain to you exactly where they get this from. It's actually in the Mishnah Berurah. Tells you don't have to drink wine, if any of you want to get out of it this year. But I'll talk about the next class. You're right, they do not drink. But I didn't know that about Rashar Yashav, because he's not a Nazir. Rashar Yashav was a Nazir until he was 16 years old. They were vegetarians also. That's another problem. We'll talk all about that. There's a great shuva in the Mincha Yisman and the Nazir. That's interesting. If you can get me it, I'd like to see it. I would also like to know whether this was some crazy man or whether we're dealing with someone who has his head on straight. Was he part of any yeshiva? Yeah, he becomes a leading figure in the Merkaz Harav yeshiva. We'll get to that all that next class.
But if people want to speak up using the transmit button, usually after the class, it's enjoying, feel free to speak.
What Baruch says is correct. Today we might... I've had students like this, and they're always these... a little bit off the beaten track, these avant-garde types, the types who read philosophy on their free time. They're always different. But in those days, everyone read philosophy, it seems, at the university. It's not like today. It was an elite institution. And Germany and Switzerland, they are very they're very conformist societies. You didn't walk around with like a mountain man or something. He certainly would have stood out. Today, I have students, they come with ponytails and all that. We don't think of it. Don't look at it very strangely, but just think someone coming in to a traditional synagogue looking like that. We know that this is, and then we're not just talking about some hippie who throws on a yarmulke and comes to shul. We're talking about someone who's an incredible Talmud Chacham who's becomes the leading student of Rav Kook. So it's very different. I don't think you can get a pulpit in America today as a Nazir. By the way, the Rugachover had very long hair. I have yet to been able to find why he never cut his hair. Maybe he just didn't think there was any Indian of it, any reason to, but he looked like a Nazirite. He wasn't, but he had long, flowing hair. Okay, yeah. They say, Bittos Man, you can't learn Torah, but I hold on a second.
Person that he come across as a very regular
person. Okay, we'll get to that. Okay, so I'll just let you respond to Rabbi Kelman. That's the legend, it was Bittos Man. I can't imagine, though... and then the Rugachover knew enough to know that even if he never yarmulke on, he could still think Torah. He came across as a very unusual person. Really, we'll speak about the next class when we speak about what he became in the land of Israel and his personality. He's obviously not the typical person. He didn't leave his house. From the time of the old city of Jerusalem was taken by the Arabs, he didn't leave his house again until 1967. So what type of person never leaves their house? I mean, we're dealing with someone who's very special and very unusual. But a tzaddik of the sort, if any of you have read Aryeh Levine, the biography of Aryeh Levine, Simcha Raz, you also have some good pictures there of the Nazir. We'll really speak about the philosophy of him again. I'll write the email down right now. You can always get it by going to the University of Scranton. But really, this is just so, giving us the background to next week when we speak about his philosophy, some of his interesting ideas, and what he became. Because had he passed away, Chas v'Shalom, in 1923, none of us would have ever heard of him. He'd have no significance. He'd be another eccentric person. But when an eccentric person becomes Gadol B'Yisrael, he's no longer eccentric. He just has a special path of Kedusha or something along those lines, you could say. That's, and it's like they say about millionaires, you know, if you're eccentric and a millionaire, it's okay, but if you're eccentric and you're poor, you're crazy. So, but he's not crazy. It's, he, as we'll see, he was trying to bring back something that was very special that we haven't had in thousands of years. And you might think that's crazy, but he didn't think so. He thought that we are living in an era that things like Ruach HaKodesh and Nevuah and a special Judaic sense of language, he thought we could bring this back, and we'll talk about the next class. And yes, his wife was on board with all of it. Look, she married a person, she married a Nazirite, and she knew perfectly well. She was just afraid that he wouldn't be able to relate to her because he was Kulo Kodesh. And, you know, he would not be able to relate to her as a person. But, no, he was able, although the Bitul Hayesh that he wrote about with Rav Kook, he was able to be a dedicated father. The only time maybe he wasn't, you might say, a, quote, dedicated father, and this is mentioned, I just thought of it, in the Ari Levine book, on Yom Kippur. On Yom Kippur, Rav Ari Levine used to have to take Rav Shar Yashiv and give him, you know, when he was 3 or 4 years old, and feed him. Because on Yom Kippur, the Nazir was so enraptured with his own tefillahs and his own, really, his Ruach HaKodesh, whatever you want to refer to it as, that he totally forgot that he had a little boy who had to eat on Yom Kippur. And if he didn't, and he wasn't feeding him, it was in a completely different world. But other than that, he was a good father, and you can read descriptions of it. And he lived a very unusual father. Put it that way. We'll talk about it next class. He had one other child. One other child becomes the husband of Rav Goren, the wife of Rav Goren, Tzivia. And Rav Goren and Rav Shar Yashiv were there for both. Were both vegetarians. They took a lot from the Nazir, as we'll see, but that's his other daughter. He became a Tzioni, we don't know. He doesn't really write about when he became a Tzioni, but, and he really shouldn't have. And Basel was an Aguda city. They were all Agudistan then, there. But when he comes to Rav Kook, he didn't become a Tzioni in the sense of Mizrahi. He became a Tzioni in the Rav Kook sense. Rav Kook was a Tzioni in that he thought that we are now having the rejuvenation, the revitalization, the Jewish people is once again becoming whole. That's not political Zionism. So yes, you need a state and all this, but it's a different type of Zionism. It's a much more spiritual Zionism. We'll see with Rav Reines, that's religious political Zionism. So it's a very different type of Zionist. But by the way, I'll show it to you again next week, but I mentioned, here's the famous picture of the Nazir of Tzvi Yehuda, the day that the Kotel falls to the IDF. First time he left his house since 1948 to go to the Kotel. We'll talk about all this next week. But if there's any questions on what we said, 2 weeks, yes. Okay, let me remind everyone. If anyone has any questions about what I said today, because I don't want to talk about all the things I'll talk about next class, I will be away next week, and I don't think I'll be back on the plane. I'm actually a scholar in residence in Chicago, and also on Monday I'm doing something, so I don't think I'll be back in time, so we decided to postpone it 1 week. We've never done it, but give us 2 weeks to think about all these things, and we'll pick up again 9 o'clock in 2 weeks. That was another chauffeur. Interesting. I did not know that. How was a guy like that able to stay in the university? Well, if you're not breaking any rules, they didn't really, you saw how he was dressed there. He was wearing a suit. Obviously, they didn't have rules about personal grooming that you couldn't have beards or anything like that. I don't know. People like that are not concerned that everyone's staring at them. He speaks in his diary, by the way, about the problem. There were women in the university in Basel. That he would make sure, he doesn't want to sit near them, that sort of thing. He goes, he listens to the lectures, and leaves. When you say frustrated, why should he be frustrated? The Jewish students in Basel University would come meet with him. He became like their father figure, their teacher. He had Talmidim at the university, he had Talmidim in the city. He was giving Shiurim, and then, of course, he meets Rav Kook. And now he's born anew, so why would he be frustrated? He's at the university for one reason and one reason only. It's not dry science. It's understanding philosophy. It's understanding this is not dry, because Torah is broad. And as we'll talk about next class, you need to know this. Like, look at the Rav. Is this dry science? The Rav is quoting in Halachic Man. He's quoting Hermann Cohen. He's quoting Kant. He's quoting Hegel. He's not just throwing it in to show off. He's quoting it because these help us grasp Torah better. If you're living in Egypt 1,000 years ago, if you're living in the ghetto, you don't need it. But in the modern world, this is what we need to understand Torah better. We're modern people. Rav David Cohen wants to be broadened. But it's not pure dry science. It's because this is going to, spiritually, this is going to be of assistance to him. Okay. I'll see you all, God willing, in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody. Okay, good night.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.